Hi, I'm Jessica Steinberg.
And I'm Amanda Borchel Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East,
and the Jewish world.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Briefing. Today is Sunday, July 31st. I'm Ann Gordon, in for Amanda Borchel Dunn. I'm here today with health and science correspondent Nathan Jaffe and diplomatic correspondent Laser Berman, still on location in Ukraine. Hello to you both.
Hi, Anne. Hi, Lisa.
There have been some interesting and exciting developments by Israeli researchers, specifically to benefit the potential sufferers of fibromyalgia and those who experience male infertility. We'll hear about what the future may hold. We'll also hear about Israel's newest and largest emergency room and what is so exciting about this facility. And we'll understand why those who are careful to get iodized salt, not a given in Israel by any means, may be new role models for the Israeli public. We'll also get the latest update on developments in Ukraine and some, quote, odious anti-Semitism at the UN. Nathan, we'll begin with you. Tell us what's new and exciting in Israeli health research on fibromyalgia in particular.
Yeah, so this is a condition that causes kind of pain, fatigue, cognitive problems. You know, it's really the bane of the life of people who have it, mostly women. And one of the kind of big challenges for the medical community with this condition is, first of all, treatment, but second of all, just basic diagnosis. Diagnosing this is generally based on symptoms, on examining symptoms, on subjective questions for patients, which makes the process very, very hard. And there's a piece of Israeli-Canadian research out now that gives hope that there could be some kind of objective diagnostic method. And this is all centered on something that I've been reporting on quite a lot, actually, which is research related to the microbiome. The idea that you can actually learn a lot about people's general health through analysis of the microbiome. There's a lot of research going on in relation to that in Israel. And this latest piece of research suggests that there may be patterns in the microbiome that actually would allow you to confirm presence of this condition and make way for a diagnostic tool. It's still quite a long way off, but the research is there. Listeners can see exactly where the research is up to in the piece that I published on this, and really kind of fascinating research.
That's really interesting. And you also had a really interesting piece about sperm, about creating sperm in the laboratory.
Okay, this is a piece of research in which scientists took stem cells from male mice who didn't yet have sperm. And what they managed to do was to grow spermatides from this, which is basically kind of free sperm. It's basically the cell structure that you get before sperm usually. And they managed to grow this from the mouse stem cells. Now you may ask, why is that exciting? Because scientists in the past have actually shown that you can actually fertilize eggs using these spermatides, not full sperm. You can fertilize eggs using spermatides. So kind of putting the pieces together, what this research could potentially do way down the line is potentially to give scientists a way of taking stem cells, of creating spermatides out of those stem cells, and of fertilizing eggs and eventually leading to pregnancies, first in mice and then eventually in humans, using all of this science that's being researched right now. So it's way, way, way off down the road. But what this Israeli lab has done has shown that the theoretical basis of some of this might be there.
Wow, that's really impressive, even if it's a long time in the future. Tell us also, Nathan, about this new, very large emergency room. I understand it's a new facility, but what is so exciting about it?
Yeah, so this is said to be the world's largest emergency room, and it's just opened at Ichilov Hospital in Tel Aviv. A lot of the money given by a Canadian Israeli philanthropist by the name of Sylvan Adams. And it's actually, you know, it opened at the end of last week, with kind of quite a high profile ceremony. And not only is it large and kind of very well equipped, but it's very well equipped in a very technological way. So, for example, you get there and obviously if you're well enough, it is an emergency room. So some people will not be able to do any of the check-in process for themselves. But if you are well enough, you can check yourself in using the electronic functions You can then go to a special area where some of the initial medical tests you actually conduct in an automated way yourself. So that makes everything more efficient. And if you're anything like me and always get lost in a hospital and need to know the way to go, then you ask one of these little robots that will help you find your way. So that's a few insights into why it's special. And the idea is that it's kind of, you know, pushing the envelope of technological innovation in emergency rooms. So we need to see how that actually becomes used practically. But there's a lot of hope there and a lot of potential in that hospital.
Do you think it's going to have influence on other emergency rooms across Israel and across the world?
I think the hope is that it might provide some models of what can be done. You know, our hope, of course, is that its true potential will never be tested because, you know, it's been set up that it can cope with emergency scenarios, terror attacks, war scenarios, which, of course, we all hope will never be put to the test and it will never have to show its true potential. I think that kind of, you know, when the world gets a hint of its potential, it will provide some interesting models.
Amen to that. It's time for a break. When we return, we'll hear about the missing iodine in Israeli diets.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Daily Briefing listeners. I'm so happy you've joined us for our daily analysis of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Like what you hear? Check out our Times Will Tell weekly podcast. Every Friday, you can hear conversations with authors, artists, archaeologists, and thought leaders from around the globe. Subscribe to Times Will Tell, our weekly half-hour feature, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy!
We are back. Okay, Nathan, why aren't Israelis getting all the iodine they should?
Okay, one of the fascinating things that's happened in this very arid, dry area in recent years is that the water crisis has become slightly less serious due to the rise of desalinated water. The technology today is there to provide large amounts of drinking water from seawater. And today, 8 out of 10 glasses of water drunk by Israelis is actually desalinated water. So this is fantastic. This is amazing in terms of providing and meeting Israel's water needs. The downside is that desalinated water lacks some of the goodness that standard water has. And one of the things that it lacks is iodine, which is really important for the human diet. It's really important, especially for certain hormone functions, especially in the thyroid. And a health ministry survey recently found that Israelis have much lower levels of iodine on average than people should. So that's one piece of research that came out recently. And the reason for my latest article is because Hebrew University researchers are now launching a national project to go around checking water supplies and to identify exactly how much iodine we're lacking. So this is a very important piece of research being conducted now by Hebrew University. And in about 6 months, we'll know just how far down our iodine is in the water supply. And I expect that there will then start kind of a significant national discussion on how to fix it, whether that means adding iodine to the water, which is sensible but is very expensive, or potentially encouraging people to buy salt with iodine or some other form of supplementing iodine intake. So this is quite a significant kind of health development, this survey and this focus on just how bad the iodine situation is in Israel.
I always buy that iodized salt. Is that recommended now?
I don't think that there is an official recommendation for it at this point, but that might change.
Okay, we'll keep our ears and eyes open for this story. Laser, turning to you. We've spoken to you several times during this trip. What's the latest in the Ukrainian front?
First of all, after hearing about mice, sperm, and hospital robots, I don't think I'll have anything as interesting as Nathan, but we will try. On Thursday, I spent time with a territorial defense battalion, originally from Kyiv. They were transferred to the Kharkiv region, so that's in northeastern Ukraine, very close to the Russian lines. And they took me around an area called Chuhuyev, which is a town southwest of Kharkiv. The two guys I was in their pickup with, it was this Mitsubishi pickup painted green in military camouflage. They were both professionals in regular life. One of them was a lawyer. One was a military psychologist. The lawyer had about 21 years of military experience. So he was a real, you know, seasoned fighter, but he was out of the active military. He's 52 years old. And like these territorial defense fighters, he volunteered to rejoin the military for this conflict. They took us around the area, which was clearly very badly hit by the Russians. We visited a number of schools which had been utterly, you know, they suffered direct hits. They were utterly gutted. Now, some of these schools were places that these soldiers were sheltering in. So by the international laws of war, they do constitute legitimate military sites if indeed that was the target. These soldiers said that they believe that locals are split about 50-50 in terms of their sympathy for Ukraine and for Russia. And they think that locals find out where they're staying and give the information to the Russians. So they try to move at least every week in terms of where they are sheltering. Now, as we were moving around, one of the soldiers in the battalion came up to me and started speaking to me in some rudimentary Hebrew. He was Jewish. He said he had taken in Ulpan in Kyiv. And then he asked me if I wanted to meet another soldier whose nickname was the rabbi. I said, of course. And he was brought out another Jewish soldier, and his son was there as well with him. So, you know, it's a big Jewish community. There's about 40,000 halachic Jews and about 200,000 people who have various connections to the Jewish community through ancestry or otherwise. And you stumble across this all the time. It becomes almost routine to find people who speak some Hebrew, have cousins in Israel, or Jewish themselves. And finally, they took us to the furthest line that these soldiers are holding. The soldiers in the battalion were digging trenches on the road to Izium, which is a Russian-controlled city. The front lines were about 2 kilometers down the road. I must say these were trenches that remind you of World War I. They were lined with wood, covered with branches. They were very well dug, very well maintained. The soldiers came from all walks of life, bartenders, car salesmen, veterinarians, very educated, very, you know, very pleasant to talk to, very eager to speak. And these are the soldiers that make up the territorial defense. That was on Thursday. On Friday, I rejoined this aid organization in Kharkiv called Sigma. I had been with them on, I believe it was Wednesday, and we visited some of the most hardly hit suburbs and neighborhoods of Kharkiv. They deliver aid packages all over the region. There is a region on the Severodonetsk River, which the bridges are all knocked out, and there are villages on the other side that they have to deliver aid to. To drive would either mean driving on roads that are controlled by the Russians or taking a 140-kilometer detour. So they row these supplies across the river. We were met by members of the Ukrainian Reserve. Again, so these are soldiers who had served and came back. So it's different than the territorial defense. Very well equipped, seemed to be very serious and well-trained soldiers. And I got onto the rowboat with one of these soldiers, and we rowed these supplies, you know, bread, fish, tuna fish cans and things like that, plenty of water. We probably made about 4 journeys across the Severodonetsk River, dropped them off to these two guys who were waiting on the other side with an old beat-up car and a wagon. And they drove them into their village. The Sigma group said they do this about once every 5 or 6 days. you know, it was a beautiful area. The weather was beautiful. You have a nice river flowing through the forest, but you can tell the soldiers were somewhat tense because they said that they're always looking out for small Russian teams of saboteurs, spies, special forces, and things like that. And of course, there's always a threat of Russian fire. We were in the range of both Russian guns and Russian missiles. And I'll just add, while I was sleeping in Kharkiv on Thursday night, early Friday morning, two or three S-300 missiles slammed into the city close enough to make the walls of the hotel shake. So the city is still being hit, and there's evidence of that all over the place.
So you weren't that far from the front?
No, it depends what the front is. Again, from the Ukrainian front, so I was about 2 kilometers back from the Ukrainian regular army, and they didn't let us go any further. From the Russian lines, we're probably saying about 15, 20 kilometers, which might sound like a lot, but this has turned into a war of fire. And Russian artillery certainly reaches that distance. And obviously, the longer range cruise missiles do as well. So we're well in the range of Russian guns. You do hear explosions. Nothing, thank God, hit us too closely. But you do drive by buildings that were hit the night before, some of them with fatal results.
Okay, to shift gears.
Yes.
You've also contributed to some recent articles about the UN. What's the story there?
Aha. So there's this UN Commission of Inquiry, which was set up last year under significant criticism from Israel and other places in the West. They have a rather unique mandate to permanently investigate Israeli occupation, Israeli crimes. And they released their first report in June, which basically put the entire onus of the conflict, of course, the occupation, as they call it, on Israel. And they say it is a system intentionally set up to discriminate, that Israel discriminates against Israeli Arabs, Palestinians in East Jerusalem, obviously Palestinians in the West Bank. It is a harsh report, and this three-member commission is going to keep investigating and keep issuing these reports that obviously are going to be highly critical of Israel. Now, Israel said from the beginning that this is evidence of anti-Semitism through its double standards. One of the three members, he's originally an architect, but he's become a human rights expert. His name is Milun Kotari. I'm sure I pronounced that wrong. But he said in an interview last Monday to Mondo Weiss, which is a very left-wing anti-Israel publication, there had been a lot of money spent to discredit this commission and the Human Rights Council in general, and that effort, including on social media, is controlled largely by the Jewish lobby. And he said that a lot of money is being thrown at trying to discredit us. These are obviously tropes and terms that are used typically in anti-Semitic parlance. And he even said that it's not clear why Israel should still be a member of the United Nations, given that it is not meeting its obligations. There's plenty of countries in the world who I think our readers and our listeners will realize that have very, very obvious and much more significant war crimes and some horrible things, and people are not trying to kick them out of the UN, and you don't have UN officials speaking like that. So this certainly did no favors to the commission itself. The commissioners started saying things like it was taken out of context, and that didn't stop Western countries, Czech Republic, UN, Britain, Germany, France, United States, of being incredibly critical of this and calling this bias and anti-Semitism. So this commission continues to be a problem for Israel, and it seems like much of the feelings of the commissioners have come out in public, which will probably make it easier for Israel to discredit. Just a final note, Israel did call for the commission to be disbanded again after this.
Wow. That's it for today's Daily Briefing. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Laser. Until next time.
Thank you, Anne.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time.
Shalom.